Hope everybody's having a nice Monday morning. Top of the week to everybody. Shavua Tov. Inching closer to Pesach preparations. We have all of the laws, the dinim of practices that we are becoming more familiar with as we get closer. The uniqueness of this year, where it is Erev Pesach Shechalios B'Shabbos, where the eve of where Passover's eve falls out on Shabbos, and all of the laws that come and pertain to that as well. So that, in its details, I'm sharing most of those laws in the addendum to the Halacha Gems, going through those laws, which there are many. So I thought what we would do in our cases that we've been studying together in Shas is to go through a Pesach-related topic. It has its roots, obviously, through Minhagim, through custom, and obviously it has lots of adaptation for this year. Like I say, our Pesach Shechalios B'Shabbos, when do we sell the chametz? When are we able to stop eating the chametz? What is it that we do when we search for the chametz? When do we search for the chametz? What do we do with the leftover chametz? When do we burn the chametz? Lots of different things. But let's just get to one of the well-known practices. We know that during this time, the few weeks leading up to Pesach, everybody has the obligation to be sure that they rid their homes of being in possession of chametz. That's a violation of the Chumash Bal Yeroe Bal Yemotze, which means you can't see it, you can't possess it, you can't have any chametz, any leaven in your house. And there's obviously, as we know, there's lots of different categories of leaven. One category is what we call chametz gomor. Chametz gomor is an actual leaven, like bread, like noodles, like actual, like cookies, things of that sort. And then there's something called this chametz. It's not actual chametz gomor, but it's like ingredients of chametz. That's still chametz, but we want to get rid of it. So obviously two parts of that. Number one is you get rid of it. Number two, you consume it, you eat it. This is when the cupboards become a little bit more and more bare. And then the second thing, which is still a minhag Yisrael, that means even if you sold, sorry, the minhag Yisrael is to sell your chametz, that even if you got rid of all your chametz, even if you ate all of your chametz, you still have to sell your chametz. Why do you have to still sell your chametz? And the answer is it's a minhag Yisrael. It's a strong Jewish custom. And there's a possibility that there are things that are in your home that you might not necessarily realize that you have. Now, it's true. You say bittul, which means you say a nullification. You rid yourself of ownership of of that chametz, actually. But still, we want to make sure to it that year after year, we do the same thing in a concept called a low plug. Low plug means that even in a situation, which we have this year also, where things are a little bit different systemically because it's Friday or Shabbos and Erev Shabbos and Sunday and things of that sort, as well, it's the first day of Pesach, we do things the same way year after year because we don't want to become confused. If we said to you that, yes, it's true, you can sell your chametz all day, or you can own your chametz all day on Friday, so then really what would happen is next year when it's not Erev Pesach Shechalios B'Shabbos, so then you're going to say that I could do the same thing. Now, you might not because you're familiar with the laws, but many people might, in fact, do that. So we want to be careful. We want to be very careful and conscientious to be sure that we do things year after year. But listen to this unbelievable case. This case involves a situation which is one of the sacred things that I do every year for my family, my extended family, of course, for my community, is sell the chametz as the agent on behalf of all of you, on behalf of everybody who comes to me and asks me to take the inventory sheets they filled out, approximating the amount of chametz that they're selling, and then I sell the chametz to the non-Jew. Now, many people over the years have thought that, you know, this is like a hocus pocus activity here. I'm selling something. You're not really selling something. They're giving it back. They're selling it back. What's the story with this? Now, let's just say by way of making sure that we understand the basics, as we mentioned, that there is a biblical prohibition to own chametz. You can't own chametz. You have to be sure that you get rid of it. Now, you could just say, so get rid of it. So you don't have to lose financially because of the fact that Pesach comes. I mean, if you have a whole, you went to Costco, you have noodles, you have chametz products, you can certainly sell your chametz and that would be fine as long as you don't own it. And that's the mechanism that has been set up by Chazal, the rabbis, to give us a chance to sell the chametz to a non-Jew. As long as a non-Jew owns the chametz, you're good to go. For that period of time, the 7 days, the 8 days, you repossess it after Pesach, it's good. But that sale and that contract and that process is extraordinary. Why? Because take, for example, let's just say you have two parties. One person is selling a piece of real estate to somebody else. So he's selling the piece of real estate to somebody else. So if I make a verbal commitment, and even if I put money in escrow and I have decided that I want this property, I've even put major skin in the game, we know that until there's a closing, there's no transfer of the property from one owner to another, right? So even though it seems to be that there's a contract, it seems that there's monies, it seems it's a deal that's pending, it's not a deal until the deal is official and sealed, until there's a closing. That's not the case that happens with regards to Mechiras Chametz. With the selling of the Chametz, what happens is on Erev Passover, Erev Pesach, so I meet with the Enu Yehuda, I meet with the person who's indicated his interest in buying this, this Chametz. I go through the inventory sheets and we do a contract. We don't have to get into all the details right now, but basically we get into a contract where we start the transaction. And that transaction is different in the sense of a real estate contract, because he makes a down payment on the contract, on the deal that he's going to do. And even though what we do is we set it up in such a way that after Pesach, literally I have him come when Pesach is over to Shul with his checkbook and with his credit card, with a way to finalize the transaction, you would think that as like it would be with a car or real estate, the transaction is only a transaction once it's complete and finished and all the monies have been transferred. This mechanism allows for there to be the beginning of the financial process to start. And that beginning financial process, even though it's not total and final and complete, nonetheless, he assumes ownership completely. Because if he didn't assume ownership completely, so then we would be in possession of Chametz on Pesach, which of course is a prohibition, which is of course an Issa, which is a violation. So that's where it's different. With real estate, you don't own it until there's a closing. With Mechiras Chametz, the non-Jew, the Enu Yehuda, he owns it right away. There has to be a down payment. There has to be signatures. There has to be a verbal agreement. There has to be kinyanim, like we lift sometimes a gartel or a pen or something that is an indication that, yes, you own it. We verbalize this. We express this. You own it. And you're just going to come to me at such and such a date and such a time. And at that time and in that place with those dollars, you're going to finalize the deal. And Shalom al Yisrael. Now, if then, which of course happens, is that I say to him, okay, did you review the inventory sheets? You looked, I have 300 inventory sheets. I have 500 inventory sheets. All told, there's about, $35,000 worth of chametz. You gave me $100 down payment. So it's or however much money you gave me as a down payment. All right, you ready to go? So he's to say, no, Rabbi, I'm not interested. I'm out. So who can cancel the deal? The person who can cancel the deal, and the only person who can cancel the deal, is the Eino Yehudi, is the non-Jew. Meaning, I can't say to him, you know what, Frank, let's just call him Frank for argument's sake. Let's say, Frank, I can't do this deal. Unfortunately, I've changed my mind. It's not my interest anymore. So I can't do that. Because if I were to do that, that would then, lima freya, retroactively suggest that I never did it. And therefore, if I never did it, so many people, scores of people would have had ownership of their chametz over Pesach, which of course we don't do, okay? That's the uniqueness of this situation. So once we know that I can't renege, I can do whatever I need to do to try to be sure to it that he reneges, but I myself can't renege. He can renege, and when he does, that's why rabbis Motzei Pesach are a little bit nervous right away after davening, running to, making sure that this all happens. Because we print in the flyers, chametz sold through the shul, we'll be back in your possession after 9 o'clock, right? So what happens if the rabbi can't get that done by 9 o'clock? And you go to your cupboard and you have a bowl of cereal, bowl of Cheerios, Crispix, Rice Krispies after Pesach. You go order, you get into your closet, you start eating whatever chametz. So that's not your chametz. I didn't do the. I wasn't able to do it. So we're under pressure. And thankfully, I could tell you, year after year, we've been successful in being able to do it. But what would happen if he decided that he wants to buy it? What would be the law then? You know, Rabbi, I was looking at some of the inventory sheets. There's some good bourbon, some good Jack Daniels, and some good whiskey. There's a lot of good chametz there. Okay, it's a little expensive, but you people are blessed, and I think that I'm going to go with it. I think I can get it at a better deal than if I were to buy it myself. What would be the halacha? So the halacha is you have to sell it to him. You have to complete the deal. But here's the unusual situation, which is part of our interesting case that we're going to get into a little bit more now, is there is a very big difference between somebody who wants to just buy the chametz because he's interested in all the chametz. Now, the good news is that I don't know anybody, really, I don't know anybody that they had that happen to them because they'll never assume, first of all, no one's going to spend $30,000 on, folders and folders of chametz that they can't really immediately access, and they're gonna have resistance when somebody comes into you're gonna go into their house and nobody's gonna really easily be able to access that. In fact, actually, I have a colleague in the Five Towns as a Rav who over Chol HaMoed in 1 year brought the non-Jew to one of the homes as a way of proving that actually it's so true that he wants to know where his chametz is, he wants to know where his whiskey is. I don't know how comfortable that made everybody, knowing that there was a possibility that we knock, knock, give me my chametz, give me my whiskey. But suffice it to say, it's legitimate. If he wants to buy it, he can. But since it really hasn't happened, so we don't really have that much to worry about. We can assume that we're going to be able to dissuade him properly, which we've always done. But here's the case, though. What happens in a situation where the Einu Yehudi, he's very motivated. He really wants to buy it. Why does he want to buy it? So the case is this. If there was a Jewish, Yehudi sheyesh lo mifal shel chametz. The case is, if you see on the sheets here, there was a Jew who had a factory of chametz. The factory of chametz, umocher es kol chametz lenachri, sold all of the chametz to a non-Jew. And la'achar Pesach, ba nachri uveviyas neseres achov. The non-Jew comes to him after Pesach with the rest of his obligation. The obligation was, let's just say, $10,000. I gave you $1,000. I'm bringing the additional $9,000. I want to finish the deal. Kedei liknas es kol ha'mifal. You know what happens? He wants to buy the whole factory. So it's not just that I see the goods and I want those goods. But listen to this next line. This is the most important part of this case. Hamatara shalo, that his intention is, v'nashel es ha'yehudi miparnasoso. He wants to steal, take away the Jews' parnasa. He sees this as a way, which is why you have to choose the Einu Yehudi carefully. If the Einu Yehudi decides, look, he's got a factory of whatever items, chametz items, sold it to me, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy it. What happens if I were to buy it, nothing to do with Pesach? Maybe I'd have to pay more money to buy that factory, buy that company. I'm going to get a good deal if I'm able to buy it for only $20,000. So I'd like to buy it. I want to take away his parnasa. Now, how much does the Jew have to know all this in advance? How discerning, how scrupulous do you have to be choosing your Einu Yehudi? How much has to be said beforehand? But it seems as if, because his matara, his intention is to take the Jew out of his business, take his parnosa, does that make a difference? If the answer is that his business is being lost, so the case brings the questioner to the Beis Din, where he's asking the Beis Din, he's asking the high court, is he obligated to sell him and culminate and complete this deal? Maybe he's not obligated to do that. Well, I have to complete this deal. Maybe I could say, maybe I, Jew, can say, no, I don't want this deal anymore because I know what you're up to. I know what you want to do. It doesn't even have to be that he's dubious. It could be that, okay, assuming he's dubious for this case, but even if he wasn't dubious, he just wants to buy your business and now he sees a way to do it. But he wants, now you're going to lose all your parnasa, you're going to lose all your business. Is this case an obligation where the Jew has to sell the chametz? So listen to this answer. Any questions so far? Interesting case. Good. So he says the following.
Wait, I do have one question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Why don't they write it into the contract that the other person has to sell it back? And then that person would be breaking the rule. You know what I mean?
Right. Because we don't want to have any stipulation that has any ownership of it. It's understood in some way, shape, or form. True, you could say that you have to sell it back at a certain date. So there's something that's not as sincere and genuine about the process. It's like I'm just getting rid of it for the holiday, which might be that would, you know, a good quick solution to the problem. But it has to be that I literally do not own it. I don't have possession of it. It's gone. It's rid. It's offer. It's offer. We say it's offer de ara. It's like dust of the land. Nothing. Not in my possession at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're worried about that. If we made that as the rule, say, I didn't really understand that. I didn't really mean it. This is a joke. I'm not giving you any money for it. He really has to buy it. Like, I'm not going to give you money. What if you decide? He could say the flip side is on the condition that you sell it back. What if I say, you know what? On the condition that we do the deal. See, like, it has to be up front, because the worst case scenario would ever be a situation where we were in possession of the chametz at any point. So the cleanest way of doing it is to make sure that it's completely and utterly sold. No ifs, ands, or buts. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So actually, this case is a proof positive of, it's actually not hocus pocus, believe it or not. It's real. It's serious. It's real. So if you see on the next page, Chayovim Lekabel, says the Beis Din the following. Chayovim Lekabel Mimenu as a Yisera. The Jew has to accept the additional payment that is brought in, velosaislo es kol hachametz, and he has to give him the rest of the chametz, everything. The business has to be sold. V'meinu moichro, because if he did not sell it to him, hare misbara l'mafreya shamachira lo haisa mechira. You know what would happen? It would be clear that the sale was never a sale. Right? If I cancel the deal, like I said before, then it's as if the sale never happened. And that's a problem. V'nimsa sha'avar ha'yehudi al bal yiro'eh. It would come out that the Jew was in violation of bal yiro'eh. That's a violation in chumash. We're not allowed to own, possess, and even actually see chametz. Okay? So the authenticity of the case would be in a situation if the Einu Yehudi who's buying the chametz from me as your agent said, I want to buy the chametz. I'm here with you. Told me, Rabbi, to bring my checkbook. I brought my checkbook. I made a decision with my spouse. I'm going to do it. So I have no choice but to say, okay, because if I didn't do it, then you'd be in trouble. Now, I don't know how that email would look. If I say, dear friends, you know, the chametz I said is back in your possession at 9 o'clock. Yeah, that's not the case. I probably would have to leave town. I probably have to just like leave town in the middle of the night. All right, whatever.
I have a question.
Yes.
How does a Beis Din have jurisdiction over an Eino Yehudi? Why should the Eino Yehudi agree to be subject to the rulings of a Beis Din as opposed to a civil court?
Great question. Excellent question. That's hotly debated. Hotly debated. Actually, there's a document that Rabbi Willig, together with the offices of the RCA, and that's the document that I use, together with a number of attorneys over the years, and Bate Dinim, that would have a universality of opinion, created a document that is the sale of the Chametz document. So meaning there's two documents that circulate. One is the inventory sheets that everybody fills out, and there's specific language in there. And as an attorney, you'll see it, and you'll pick up like some of the specific language that Rabbi Willig felt strongly, Rabbi Schefter felt strongly should be in there. But then there's a language that is between the non-Jew and the Jew. And is it a binding document? Like I have language in there that it is a contract that theoretically, if there was some type of dispute, it actually says it in there. I can show it to you if you're interested. It's like a 4-page document that isn't just like, you know, oh, by the way, when this doesn't work out, we're going to go to Beis Din. He's like, what is a Beis Din? I don't even know what a Beis Din is. It says that Florida law and per the witnesses that are here and per the handshake and the agreement and the signatures that you're signing, it's not notarized. And it's, you know, there's certainly not, you know.
No, look, two people are allowed to appoint anybody to be an arbitrator. You know, we agree to go to this other person to resolve our dispute. You're allowed to do that. The only question in my mind is whether the Eino Yehudi really understands what he is signing. Because right. if he doesn't understand what he's signing, there's an out, so to speak, that this sure. It's called the contract of adhesion. I never understood what I was signing. You didn't, you know, and therefore it's not enforceable.
Right. What's the word you use? Contract of?
Adhesion.
Adhesion. Right. So in our vernacular, in Talmud vernacular, we call it a mekachtos, right? A mekachtos is that it was a deal that was a mistaken deal. It wasn't
big,
real. A
big mistake.
Big mistake. Big abysmal misunderstanding, right? So it's interesting. If you're interested, over the years now, I've accumulated a group of people that like watch this whole process. I know there's some rabbanim that put it all on Facebook Live and they show the whole thing, which is beautiful. It's a chinuch. It's a nice thing. I definitely, you know, I'm always a little bit reticent personally to do a lot of those things very publicly in front of with other people because I always think that they get a little nervous and other people might feel, you know, a little bit uncomfortable. But I do have a group of people that watch me sell it, and I certainly have a group of people that watch me buy it back. And the reason why I mention that to you is because in the process, there's like 5 different parts in a 4-page document where I have to say, I like it's now like very robotic at this point for me. I'm trained. When I stop, I repeat it twice. We have a handshake. Are we clear? Sign at this point. Like I have to actually read the whole document. Are you clear? There was somebody I saw the chametz to a few years ago. Well, I felt like his English was 75%. It was good enough that he understood it, but I wanted him to come with somebody who I felt, a family member, could really, really understand and translate what was being said specifically for this reason. Yeah, like if I take a gartel and I pick it up with him, it's like, what are you doing? You're like taking a piece of string. You didn't know what that is. So I say, the language says, per our handshake is the common understanding of compliance and realization of what your signature, what your initials, what you're nodding, what our handshake does. But listen, it's not so simple. And actually,
I understand.
Yeah. What's interesting is that the third paragraph is really going to be the kicker. The third paragraph is going to be the kicker, because at the end of the day, the end of the day, you can't hold a non-Jew to a beis din. Like, you just, we know that we can't do that, right? We can't. Arbitration, you can take him to court, whatever it is. In fact, actually, it's a very sad story, but there's a fellow by the name of Mr. Brown. So Mr. Brown has been selling Rabbi Willig's community's chametz for years. He's a famous guy. In fact, Rabbi Willig started over, I don't know, probably the past 4 or 5 years, he created, obviously in a large conference room, a lot of Rabbanim from New York, New Jersey, they come and sell together with Rabbi Willig, who is one of the Iskan Beis Din of the Beis Din of America. And he is like the main agent, and all the Rabbanim are sitting there with their individual folders. They put them as an aggregate of all of them together, and he sells them. Especially with coronavirus last year, especially, he sold, I don't know, thousands and thousands and thousands of units of inventory sheets to this Mr. Brown. Anyway, this year, Mr. Brown died. And Rabbi Willig actually would speak about him in the most glowing. He was like a very, very upstanding, very close to him. They were very good friends. And he understood it, and what he explained to somebody. It's like the slippery slope. You know, let's say you have a non-Jew that works in your house on Shabbos. So at some point, you want to like sit them down before Shabbos and explain to them what's going on. Like, otherwise, there was a housekeeper that used to work in my parents' house for years, and she would always think like my siblings and myself were so weird, because we'd be like, like all this, these sounds about the lights and the noise. And it's like, sometimes you just like sit them down. Okay, listen, it's Thursday, but here's the story. Shabbos, this and this you could do and this you can't do. So it's a delicate dance between like telling them like in advance of what's happening and keeping the authenticity of what's happening, so they don't really know what's going to be. Famously, it's been asked, like, maybe we're obligated to have a different Einu Yehudi every year, because after year one, all right, he already knows the drill. Like, how genuine is it? And the answer is, you have to, Rabbi Willig says, and I do this every year, is you have to really tell that person, this is real, this is genuine, I really want you to come with your checkbook, you know, like almost like push them to do it, whatever. Anyway, this non-Jew, Mr. Brown, he died. And last year, Rabbi Willig sold so much chametz with all, you know, on behalf of so many Rabbanim, because nobody could get together like they did in the past. And he died. And apparently there was an obituary piece about this Mr. Brown. And the last line is that he was famous for owning the Passover chametz for thousands of Jews over many, many, many years. And it was like an accolade that Rabbi Willig shared, you know, with the Rabbanim, and it was shared around a little bit, but it's an interesting, you know, relationship that they had. And it's, you know, I know that he's trying to figure out who's going to be that other person. So sure. But we're going to see that they're not really held to you have to find a high integrity person, both a high integrity Rav and a high integrity non-Jew is going to like do this the way it needs to be done. But at the end of the day, we're going to see in the third paragraph, as this case comes, when we end this case, that at the end of the day, really, there isn't really much you're going to be able to do. But this is what we're going to see. I don't know if the conclusion of this case is something that could ever happen. I have like wishful thinking. I don't know if it could ever happen, but it's an interesting case nonetheless. So look at this. The second paragraph is, so that's the law is that he has to pay. He has to accept the money. And if he didn't do it, it would call to question this whole thing. Fine. Second paragraph. So he says, I'll just translate this part in English. He says, the author here, he explains that he heard from Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who heard a story from his father. His father was the stipler gaon, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. And he wrote a sefer called Kehilos Yaakov. And he said he heard this story. And it was the same story that there was a pundikai. What's a pundikai? Pundikai is an innkeeper. And this innkeeper sold whiskey, Yayin Sarif. He sold whiskey to a non-Jew before Pesach, like he had to. And after Pesach, he came, the non-Jew, he came with all the extra money, and he wanted to then take his business. So, and his intention was to take his business and put the Jewish person out of business, to take his, take all his product, to take all of his whiskey. So this is actually a case that happened. And the reason why it's important to mention not just the case in this peripheral as the question is asked, but actually, you know, how many years ago it was that the stipler, that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, had this case or heard this case about this innkeeper, because that brings us to the third paragraph. And this third paragraph is fascinating because, okay, here's the case. It's an innkeeper. This non-Jew buys all this whiskey, and now he doesn't know what to do. He wants to now take over the guy's business. So what do you do when you're in doubt? So they went to the rabbi. Third paragraph. Kishaboy ha'inyan l'rav. They went and they brought the topic of contention to the rabbi. So he interprets these dealings and he rules on these dealings. He has to give a psak halacha. What is the rabbi going to say? So he says this. He says, Hanachri shilem ba'ad hayayin saruf. He has to sell, the Jew has to sell to the non-Jew, with the non-Jew completing this transaction by paying him the full amount. And the Jew, Mosulas Apundak, he has to give him the inn, he has to give him the factory. You know, in those days, you know, they rented the factory along with the product, which means if you were selling, I don't know, whatever it was that you were selling, you didn't sell it independent of the factory. The factory and the product went together. So if you bought all of my inventory, so I don't need the inn anymore. The inn is just the place that I have my inventory. So now you bought all my inventory, it comes with the inn. So the rabbi doesn't mention who the Rav was, but the Rav, who rules on this interaction, this altercation of sorts, he says that the non-Jew has to pay in full for all of the whiskey. The Jew has to give him the merchandise and the whole house with it. Now listen to this. This is like blow away. I don't know if we could ever get away with this. However, achar kach hitel es harav, after this happened, hitel es harav cheirim. He put a cheirim. He excommunicated al kol misha yikne ma'anachra ayayin sarov. So the rabbi made a kol kore, made a cheirim, and he said, nobody should buy the whiskey from this non-Jew. Now, let me say like a little tongue-in-cheek here. The only reason why this would seem to be okay is the assumption of a dubious activity to rid the Jew of his parnasa, to steal the Jew's parnasa, to do something not nice to the Jewish people. But I don't know that I would think that that would be something that would be the same ruling if just the non-Jew just wanted to buy the chametz. You couldn't put a cheirim. I don't think that the rabbanim would put a cheirim on a non-Jew who wants to just simply do what he was asked to do. It's not his fault that he wants to do it. If he really truly wants to buy all the chametz for $20,000, okay. So like, that's what it is. That's why when I tell people to put the inventory on their inventory sheets, really approximately how much it is, got to be genuine, because what happens is that he actually is supposed to look through the inventory sheets. He says $300 and $500 and $1,000 and $2,000. I mean, it becomes a big number, and that's supposed to ultimately dissuade him. Fine. So the rabbi puts this Einu Yehudi in Cheirim, and in the sense that he puts him in Cheirim, he said he's going to put into Cheirim, I'll call Mishi Yikna Me'an Nachri Shayayin Yov. He didn't put the non-Jew in Cheirim, because the non-Jew doesn't go into Cheirim. He put anybody who's going to buy the whiskey from this non-Jew, because of what he did. He would put them in Cheirim. So what would happen today if the rabbi did that? So today, maybe some people say, oh, the rabbi's going to put me in Cheirim. I'm going to go buy Dafka. Like, you know, maybe I'm going to specifically do it. I don't know if anybody can get away with this today. But that's what he said. Hanochri, so listen, this is fascinating. Third line. Hanochri Yosha Bechanuso Vehimtin Likoinim. The non-Jew was sitting at the store and he was waiting for people to come and to buy. And ulam af Yehudi lo nichnas liknos. You know what happened? Not a single Jew came, because if the Rav made such a statement, so the rabbi made such a statement, so the Jews follow. It's very interesting, because it's part of my morning activities is we were trying very hard and very desperately to help a woman get a get. And a number of the rabbanim in town have been working on it for quite some time and very, very aggressively. Some more publicly displaying that, some less so, but all in concert, all in tandem to try to very much try to get this woman to get. But one of the things that we found is that to get all the rabbis on the same table, now the local rabbanim are on the same table, but once you start getting rabbis, you know, start talking about different zip codes in different areas, everyone's got an opinion, everyone's got this, you have a clog on the runway, because you got so many people, you know, opining on what should be. Here you have the Rav, and the Rav in the town, he makes this decision, this Zecherim, and nobody buys. This owner now, this non-Jewish store owner, he's waiting, nobody comes. So here's what's fascinating. So since this was the case, no Jews went to service this business. Fourth line, not only was it that the Jews didn't go, Vigam Hagoyim, also the non-Jews, Pochtu Me'acherim She'itel Rav. The non-Jews were scared of the cheirim of the rabbi. Now, were the non-Jews going to be put into cheirim? They weren't going to be put into cheirim. But they said, if the rabbi makes such a statement and he would put his congregation in cheirim for buying the whiskey in this store, they themselves were scared to go. They didn't want to go. That is in the high esteem and regard that they felt of this rabbi. So b'sofo shel davar, at the end of the day, neletz agoy limkor b'chazoras hayayin yovish, hayayin sorfer liyhudi balapondik. So what happened was, he says, what am I going to keep this business for? I can't keep this business. He was happy. You know what happened? He resold the business back to the Jew, and everything was okay in that case. Because what he was trying to do was to take the Jew's business parnas away from him. He wasn't able to do. Now, the fact that the Jew wanted to rebuy the business, he was very lucky. He could have said, okay, listen, I don't have to buy the business. The business has no value to you. You could be stuck with all the merchandise. You could be stuck with having to, whatever you put down as a down payment or whatever it is that you paid me in full. Okay, you'll swallow that. You want to give me the merchandise? Give me the merchandise. Maybe I could, you know, buy it for 10 cents on the dollar. I could buy it much cheaper. No. The non-Jew said, at the end of the day, let me just be happy. I'll sell it back to him for what it was, and I'm going to get out of this. No problem. That's the cheirim that was put on by this rabbi to the Jews, and the non-Jews felt scared of this cheirim as well. They were worried that they themselves were going to put the cheirim, but they were scared that if this prominent person put his people into cheirim, must be that it's significant, and so therefore he was no longer interested, and he was just very happy, A, to just get out of this business and to be able to make money, whatever money he was able that he put in, be able to get that money back out. Now, again, this would only work in a situation where it's vinoshal. He wants very much to take his matar, his intention is to take the parnas away from a Jew. But if his intention is just really to buy it, then again, I don't think that would be the conclusion. So that's an interesting case. What do you think about that?
Pretty powerful, that paper.
Yeah. First of all, I'm so proud of that whole community that they did. And I don't, you know, were they all just scared of the rabbi, or did they really have a moral compass and realize that what that person was doing was really unjust? And, you know, and karma can bite you also if you don't do the right thing. So yay, I'm glad that worked out. It's a good model for how people should be.
For sure. So that's what I would say. It's for sure a good model for how people should be. I don't know if it's that they were scared of the rabbi. I think that there is a reverence and a deference. And clearly there was a respect and an honor that the rabbi was shown as the Morad Asra of that town. I gotta believe that there might have been some people who said, that's crazy, come on, like, really, I can't buy any whiskey? Does the rabbi know that I'm a big drinker? Like, it's gotta be, this is nuts. And the answer is that sometimes, like, you know, when you give an answer to somebody and it's not the answer they were looking for, so the real test of your relationship or allegiance is when it's that, not just, that's what I thought it should be. Good answer, Rabbi, you know? Or, you know what? Not really the answer I was looking for, but, you know, that's what it was. That's what it is. And I'm talking for myself, who asked questions to my own Rabbi. You know, that's what it is. You just, you know, there is a moral compass associated with, if that's what it is, that's what it is. Might not necessarily be that's what everybody's happy place is, but... For sure, it is a happy ending. But part of it is not only that it's a happy ending of the community that rallies behind, supports the opinion of, understands that they might not necessarily understand every part of it, but if that's the rabbi decides, it's good, that's what it is. But more than that, to me, is, you know, we talk a lot about being an or lagoyim, a light into the nation. And the fact that there was clearly, I like to read this tshuva, this response, that the non-Jews had such a respect for the rabbis also. If the rabbi felt that it's so important to feel such a way, then that's what it is. You know, you all know what happened with the Miami Heat player, right? Where he makes an anti-Semitic slur. So you know what happened? So there are a group of Rabbanim that actually were able to reach out to him and converse with him and educate him and actually talk to him. And look, you know, listen, obviously you can't quickly pass, you know, statements that are said derogatory, anti-Semitic easily. But what there is sometimes, what we realize, there is a gross, you know, ineptitude. There's a gross lack of understanding, a negligence, obviously. But what I can tell you is that, I forget about whether he did this because he was fined, but he did retract some of his statement because he had an educated conversation, an informing conversation with local rabbanim, which, again, authenticity aside, like, okay, it's a good... It's a good activity. It's a good action. It's a good thing to say that when a non-Jew sees and respects the activity of a Jew like that, I feel like there's something that, that might've gone well when we live in a world that sometimes that like doesn't happen.
Rabbi, do you think that, I don't know very much at all about the remedies that Besdin in modern times uses when people don't follow what they're supposed to. But do the Besdin use Harem today against other Jews, like in get situations and things like that? They do.
Absolutely. For sure. Well, yeah, there's a process, obviously. The process is pretty explicit, which is, you know, let's just say somebody is, it's not just a get case, but we could talk about a get case. Let's just say, you know, there's you call somebody to a Beis Din. It's what we call, it's a hazmana. Hazmana is an invitation to the Beis Din, right? So that person chooses, it could be that just two parties that are having, you know, a civil dispute. And the fellow decides he's not going to the Beis Din. He's just not going to answer the hazmana. So then there's a second hazmana. And then there's a third hazmana. If he doesn't answer three hazmanos, what happens then is something called a siruv. He's mesariv le-Beis Din, which means he is, in our world, it would be called, you know, I guess, contempt of court, or he's unwilling to present himself. Now, that's not just like no big deal. That is a status. That means a person becomes known as mesariv le-Beis Din. He will not appear in front of a Beis Din. Now, unfortunately, there's a lot of hocus pocus with that. What people do, certainly in cases of gittin, they'll say, well, the reason why I'm not showing up is because that Beis Din is not a real Beis Din. It's a YU Beis Din, it's a Lakewood Beis Din, it's a this Beis Din, it's out. People then start becoming a Reshka Bahag and determining what Beis Din's a Beis Din, which obviously that becomes very complicated. Listen, I'm sad to tell you, if you open up the Jewish press, if you open up the Hamodia, there are sections in these newspapers where they have, you know, you'll see the name of this person, you have lists of people that are Messiah of the Beis Din, or this man has not given his wife a get. He's got a story, they've got a story, but at the end of the day, you know, you didn't give her a get. So that's tragic. So yeah, the explanation, the expectation, I should say rather, is yeah, that this, such a person shouldn't be given aliyahs, that person should not be given membership, that person should be shunned from the community and things of that sort. So that is a cherem of sorts, which can be relinquished, assuming he just shows up to the Beis Din. It's funny because sometimes what I've found is that some of these parties, they end up not helping their own self, their own case, because what they do is they choose not to show up at the Beis Din because they say that the Beis Din is not a reputable Beis Din. To say, for example, the Beis Din of America is not a reputable Beis Din is like, just not only is it false, categorically false, but it's also shooting yourself in the foot. It's declaring your guilt, because the Beis Din does not rule on the case. Actually, what they do is they're just promulgating people to show up at a Beis Din. And when you don't show up to a Beis Din, you are a messiah of the Beis Din. You know, a person will say the Beis Din ruled that I shouldn't have this and I shouldn't have that. The Beis Din didn't even hear your case. You didn't even give the Beis Din a chance to hear your case. Maybe if you went to the Beis Din would say you're right. Right? So what we always try to do is try to encourage people to go to the Beis Din. And there are things that we hope will be solved at a Beis Din before they have to go to a secular court. Now, obviously, there's situations that have to go to secular court because they can't, not every case can be ameliorated in a Beis Din. There's lots of complications, but, you know, I'm happy to tell you that there have been a number of situations that over the years that have been able to go to a Beis Din and have been settled in a Beis Din. Now, was everybody like super duper happy about all the parts of it? Nobody's ever super duper happy about every single part of it, but yeah, they have the power of a cherem in that sense. Now, the problem is not the Beis Din. The problem are the communities. You can have one rav will say that Beis Din is correct. One rav will say that Beis Din is not correct. What has to happen then? There needs to be like an achdus. There needs to be some level of like signature togetherness of everybody's a common mind set that everybody would do. It doesn't really help. And we've seen this over the years here, is that if, let's just say, I mean, without obviously mentioning any names, but you know, if let's just say you have three shuls in town here, and you have one person who two of the rat, we decide that we're not going to let this person into our shuls because of whatever the reason. It's a cherem of sorts. It, you know, a cherem in those days, there was a document. It was on the loudspeaker. It was like, you know, it is where they plastered on the walls. You know, they plastered on the walls. That was it. Like emails went out. We haven't done that so much. Although, when there have been situations of sexual predators or things of the like, the Rabbanim have met, we've said that such people are not allowed in the shul. Now, it doesn't help if one of the Rabbanim lets that person in. Two of the Rabbanim don't, and one does, right? Because then, so the people just start hopping around to wherever they're going to be welcome. It's only as strong as the enforceable body, and the enforceable body has to be a unified front. So if I got an email this morning from a Beis Din in Israel, and the Beis Din in Israel is signed by the Rav Rashi, the chief rabbi in that location, and the Rabbanut, and the letter went to the Rabbanim here in South Florida, and mostly in Boca Raton, because this person who left Israel has avoided giving his wife a get, and he's going to reside in Hollywood and Boca Raton and North Miami Beach and things of that sort, because he's trying to avoid his obligation, sparing those details. So sure, what do I do now? I have two choices. I guess I could decide if I believe that Beis Din and open up a case myself and hire people to help me investigate, or I could just, which I did, like all my colleagues do, is that okay? If that person showed up in my shul, he wouldn't be welcome. He wouldn't be welcome because that's like, either I believe in the chief rabbinate or I don't, right? I'm sure that's a conversation for another time, but suffice it to say, if there would be a body that everybody agrees with, then theoretically, then obviously we have that obligation to hold true to it, which is interesting. All right. One final thought here, because I know that if you look at the bottom case, and I'll just tell you outside, this is also just very interesting because so many weeks before Pesach, the bottom case was also very interesting. The case was, imagine your business is in recyclables. So you recycle for business. So you know how in New York State, New Jersey, you can return the bottle, the can, back to the store, the bodega, and they give you back, right, some money. So let's just say your business, you collect recyclable containers. And let's just say it was that in this case, this fellow is asking, what type of containers does he collect? Beer bottles. So let's just say you take beer bottles. Are you allowed to take beer bottles, recycle them on Pesach? Why not? On one hand, you should be allowed to, because there's nothing inside these bottles. They're empty. On the other hand, there's still always a little bit of remnant of something in those bottles. Like, it's not like they're washed out completely. Is there just a little bit? And if you were to take the combination of all of these beer bottle remnants, then maybe you have something substantial, and then you're in violation of that. So I'm just telling this to this case outside. We'll end here because I know we're at the top of the hour. But fascinating case. We know that the remainder of it is a problem. We're worried about somebody eating chametz on Pesach. And theoretically, if a person could be assumed to drink the beer of all those remnants, then you would not be allowed to do that. You would have to suspend that part of your business on Pesach. However, and this is actually interesting for the times we live in, that today nobody wants a drink. I don't think nobody, you don't have to be a germaphobe to not want to drink from a beer bottle that came back, right? You collect beer bottles, you have a bin outside your house or wherever it is. You're not going to drink the remnants. You have to be like highly desperate and hugely destitute to want to do that. I don't propose or suppose that would be the case, but it's just an interesting situation. If it's not actual chametz, but it's even a remnant of the chametz, maybe you would think that you shouldn't, because we know that for chametz, we're careful for even a mashu, even a small minimal amount. So since he says that people today are unwilling to drink a bottle from somebody that they don't know, because those people could have some type of illness, some type of sickness, some type of communicable transmission of a disease, right? Like what we've been all hoping to avoid. So therefore it's assumed that this guy's not going to come to eat it. He's not going to come to drink it. And once it's that, we can assume he's not going to come to eat it, not to drink it, then it's not a problem. Now, having actual chametz, that's not allowed. Even if you'll say I'm not going to eat that. That's not my, let's say I'm holding somebody else's chametz for them. I don't eat that type of food. Answer is that there's always a possibility. You're like starving at night, but you're not going to, the deterrent is not that it's food, because if it's food, you'll eat it. There's always a possibility that you'll eat it. The deterrent is that somebody else drank from it. and the fact they drank from it, and that person is unknown to you, so you're not going to do it. And therefore, that's the case. Even in a situation where a person collected that those items to be recycled, so then still he'd be able to go ahead and still do that business. That's just another interesting little situation. Anyway, the bottom line is, I certainly do encourage everybody to sell their chametz, and I am super careful about choosing the non-Jew, and let's just keep our fingers crossed that we don't have a situation this year. I don't even want to craft or draft any email, and probably, Sid, if I had to, I'd probably have to add your name, but probably I would spare you maybe we could leave town together. If that happens, we could leave town together. We could decide to find a nice location and start a new, but I don't expect that to happen. But that's the story. All right. I apologize again for the delay start, but I'm happy we got to still make very good use of our time. Interesting cases. We'll fill out those inventory sheets, sell your chametz, and continue to learn together and be inspired. Thank you so much for listening and learning together. Wish everybody a wonderful rest of your day.